the notion of dying with dignity is one we associate with our elders, with the wise. And what I love about your book is that it's both about becoming, as mentioned, better ancestors, but it's also about this idea that we can also be more compassionate descendants. I felt that was a really important theme in your book, is understanding what you got, not just from the good sides of your ancestors and your grandmothers, but also their dark sides. Can you tell me more about your two grandmothers and their influence on your life?
I think the thing about the grandmothers is also important, because I have not met my grandfathers. Both were long gone when I was born. So I was born in this mixed heritage family with German and Guarani ancestry. Guarani, one of the indigenous people from Brazil. And my dad, as a German descendant, but he identifies as German actually as well, he married my mom because from the end of the Second World War to mid-60s and beginning of the 70s, there was agrarian expansion in Brazil that his brothers were involved in. And this agrarian expansion included the genocide of indigenous people, including killing indigenous people, and including the impunity of killing indigenous people. And his brothers would actually talk about that, and not in a very good way. So he wanted to make a stand against the injustice that he saw of state-sanctioned violence against indigenous people. But he wanted to do that in a way that also elevated his own heroism, right? So he married my mom. He chose to marry an indigenous person, also to help genetically her be enfranchised by whitening up, right? Future generations. So I was a project of both a progressive dimension of saving indigenous people, but also of racism, of trying to inculcate a sense of superiority of the German culture over the indigenous people. So being born in that interface created in my family a microcosm of what you can see in society. And I could see firsthand what these violences do to the bodies involved. And this included the two grandmothers were still with us when I was growing up. So my German grandmother, she treated my mother extremely badly because of the color of her skin, but she took me in as her favorite grandchild from the beginning. So there was a very strong connection with her. She was a seamstress, and she managed to raise 6 kids as a seamstress in Brazil in a period where during the war, the Second World War, people who spoke German in the south of Brazil were being persecuted. So she had to keep running away from persecution and ended up in different colonies. Actually, it was an Italian colony that she found shelter in, and they were extremely poor. There was famine at the time, and my dad says that he knows what it feels like because he experienced that famine. But she was relentless in terms of facing all these difficulties and adversities, probably also fueled by the cultural superiority of her Germanness. But as a seamstress, the work stamina that she had was unbelievable. She died actually washing dishes in an outside tank because she didn't want to use a washing machine for the clothes, right? Now, on my grandmother, my indigenous grandmother's side, she could see the reality from an indigenous perspective in a way that she actually said, she would say several times that this was unsustainable and that she didn't use the house of modernity, but she would say that this is going to collapse. And when that happens, those who are still alive would be thinking that they might not want to be. She had that prophetic intellect who could see where things were coming from, where things were going to. And she warned my mom that being carried up the ladder of social mobility was not actually a good deal. It was like buying a ticket for the Titanic because at some point you would have to reckon with the violence of the latter and the unsustainability of the latter. My Indigenous grandma also had a very difficult life growing up and going to missionary school, running away from missionary school, but she had a faith that was unshakable. So she would actually go to the church to sing, even though she was not Catholic, and she would sing out loud and out of tune to the despair of my mom, because that was extremely, it caused a lot of shame, right? And that's why my mom, for a long time, disidentified with Indigenous people. Also because she was born in the streets. So at some point, my grandma was homeless, and that was the time when she had my mom. So for 2 years, my mom was living in the streets with my grandma. All these layers of identification, disidentification, racism and discrimination, and the historical weight of what has happened and people responding differently to this historical weight, some people wanting modernity, some people rejecting modernity, some people just working through modernity and trying to protect their families, and witnessing the work of the two grandmothers and the gifts that they have bestowed upon me, I guess, one being the work stamina, the other one being this irreverence and the insight, this diachronic thinking, right? Like, where is this going? Like, where is this coming from? Where is this going? How come? And where do I position myself in this? And what is my responsibility with the whole? That comes from the Indigenous grandmother. And I think part of it too is, I don't know if it is epigenetic or something to do with this mixture conditioned in the mixture of cultures, but the capacity to feel pain. So I'm very sensitive to the pain of others and of the world. And for a long time, I really didn't want to be sensitive to these things because you don't know how to deal with it, right? So you take it in. You see the earth hurting, other people hurting, the other animals hurting, the plants hurting, and you don't know what to do with it. And Indigenous cultures, now that I've been through other processes, I know that for an individual heart, this pain is overwhelming. And of course, you're going to be diagnosed as at least depressed, if not much worse, right? For feeling this pain, for not denying the entanglement. And I'm sure if I was given the option, I would have severed it because it was excruciating, especially as a young person, having to feel all of that and not know what to do. So the collective processes that Indigenous people have to hold this pain collectively, to collectivize our heart, and the discipline you have to have not to turn away and to help it move, has been the greatest gift that my grandmother, she couldn't give it to me because she passed away too early in my life for that to be the gift. But other Indigenous people from her community and from other communities have made it extremely clear that unless we compost this, unless we feel what we have repressed and learn to move it collectively, there's no way we're going to end up in a good place. The process of maturity involves moving this pain together and repressing it, denying it. It's as you said, right? We will die by suicide if we continue like that. And as somebody who has tried, this is not the place we want to go.
Another way of talking of active addiction, which in my case included things like crystal meth, is definitely a form of suicide. I mean, there's no, you know, it's a planned or not planned or not always acknowledged, but definitely a form of suicide. We talked about your mixed heritage and your grandmothers and how your specific family story and context allowed you to grapple with some of the things that you spoke since then, like entanglement and complexity, and how people with the best intentions can do horrible things, and how the racists can behave in a really beautiful way at a certain moment. And, you know, I always thought of myself as a translator. I'm of mixed heritage in a very different way, but I have a whole bunch of nationalities in my family, and we're from all over the place, and we keep moving. And I always loved bringing different people together, et cetera. And when I met you, I thought, okay, I found my master. That's a completely new level of completely unseen capacity for me of bringing different perspectives together and sort of seeing how the intricacies of this ecosystem and how it's allowed you to go always beyond. You've had a career that's taken you to New Zealand and Ireland and Finland. And so you've broadened the translation capacity as you moved around the world. And in a way, in my book, I make the case that that is what nomadism allows us to do. It's to take this translation to new places and to make it broader. I'd like to come back to this idea of being both better ancestors, but also more understanding descendants. There seems to be a real risk of a civil war between generations of activists who come at issues like climate breakdown and inequality and coloniality in a very, very different way. And it seems that there's a real risk right now that these generations of activists can't understand each other anymore, and that really a kind of civil war could emerge. Can you speak to that?
Okay. So I think the first thing to recognize is that the gap has never been so wide because of the pace and speed of change. Things are changing on the go, and it's very difficult to keep up with where things are. So between generations, there is that incredible gap. But I think something runs through, and I think that might be what is creating the civil war situation, which is something that actually comes from modernity, which is a form of politics based on five E's. The first one is exceptionalism, right? So exceptionalism, not just in terms of human exceptionalism, but the idea of receiving the right to a platform based on being exceptional. And young people are playing with that in a way that has never happened before. So the more senior generations are not used to that, but they are used to more stable forms of authoritative power. Whereas for the younger people, this is much more dynamic and it changes very fast. So first one is exceptionalism. The second one is exaltedness. We have built this politics based on exalting heroes or intellectuals or deeds, monuments, right? Building monuments. And there is a difference between how these two groups of generations approach this, but the exaltedness principle is not being questioned. It's just different types of exaltedness. So let's say the younger people want to bring down the monuments that were built by the senior generations, but they have their own ways of creating monuments. Let's say today it's the number of views on YouTube that you get, right? So the way of building monuments for exaltedness is the same. Then there is the third thing, which is the empowerment of the ego. It's a politics that is based on the empowerment of the ego, of personalities that are going to have this leadership approach to change things. And the more recent generations are told through the internet that everybody can be that, right? And they are competing for that. Whereas the older generations, it was much more established and regulated, not in the most generative ways, actually in quite violent ways, but they didn't have that idea that everybody could have the platform, could have the space. Then there's also the politics based on expansion of entitlements. And in settler colonial states like Canada and in the US and Brazil, this is about the expansion of colonial entitlements. So everybody wants more of the stage. and of the capacity to determine other things. And the last one is the externalization of blame. So we always think about emancipation from an oppressive force by looking at ourselves as just the victim, the innocent victims of it, right? So with these five E's as a form of politics, you can see that the only possible outcome will be entitlements fighting entitlements, exceptionalism fighting exceptionalisms, exaltedness fighting exaltedness, egos fighting egos, and people blaming each other. So unless we can find a different form of politics by understanding the problems with the current one, I don't see any way out of that. So my process of translation between these two different sets of senses and sensibilities is to invite into another space that we have characterized as SMDA, sobriety, maturity, discernment, and accountability, where we don't act from compulsions, where we do not self-infantilize, where we can layer things. Rather than broaden things, I think we need to layer things so that we can keep the paradoxes and tensions and contradictions in view and learn to hold space for all of that. In that sense, we need to layer both reality and ourselves within it, right? Understanding we're not just one thing, we're many things. And I think your book gestures towards that too, like how travel and immersive experiences, not just touristic experiences in different places, can teach you about yourself that you're not just, number one, you're not self-transparent. Number two, you're not univocal. Number three, you are not pure. you are interpolated by many different things, most of which are unknowable even to yourself. And sitting with that unknowability of both reality and the self and still being able to operate and navigate within it with accountability, which means doing what's needed rather than what's comfortable and convenient. Doing what's needed is not necessarily what you want to do or what your self-interest would tell you is the best thing for you, but that's what's needed for healing, for collective healing, for individual healing, for the healing of the metabolism. So a politics based on healing requires an understanding that there is a disease we need to recover from. There are addictions we need to recover from. And that translation depends on that, depends on people being able to sit with the realness of the situation, which in itself is already a challenge, and not turning away, understanding that there is a different way of existing with all this predicament and with the shit and with all the problems that come with it and the conflicts, right? There is another way. And I think that the weaving of the way will depend on the translators who are in between. And you were one of them, Felix. Do not put it on me. We're all part of this.
It's a real privilege to be on this journey. You're what, in my world of recovery, you are what one would call, I'm afraid, an old timer. But listen, Vanessa, I want to thank you for taking the time to walk me through this, to walk us through this. Your work and the way you move in this world has really changed my way of moving around this world. As I said, it's not always easy, far from it. If you want to have self-esteem, do esteemable things. And slowly but surely, it's allowing me to do that. We talked about sitting with painful things. I have the privilege of being part of an ongoing conversation that you've organized and that you curate. I was reminded recently of what happened when I lost my great-grandmother. I wanted to do drugs. It was a Saturday. I was with my friends. I was 13 or 14, and there was a party. And I found out, I remember, I was at the beginning of the party, and I got this phone call from my mom telling me that Mimi had passed away. And I just made a conscious decision. I'll probably grieve, but I'm not now. Mm-hmm. And I went on because I wanted to party with my friends, and I blocked the information consciously. I missed something really important at that point in my life. And I missed it because I didn't want to sit with it. And so I want to acknowledge David Lertzman, who was part of this ongoing conversation and who died last week following a bear attack. And just to take a moment before we part to acknowledge his memory and his widow and his children. One of the words that comes to mind about what we're trying to do is the term propriety, which is not a very fashionable word these days, but behaving in an appropriate way is not something that I was wired for most of the time. But this is a good time to remember David and his contradictions and, to give him a bit of bandwidth right here, right now.
In his heart, in the songs of his heart, which were all about bringing everybody together. I learned a lot last week after his passing because he was responsible for an intensive course that he asked me to start with him. And he had lined up many Indigenous speakers and speakers who were very close friends of him. And once I believe he would have described the incident as a fatal encounter with a bear. He was very connected to bears. And every time I had to write about it to tell other people, I was refraining from descriptions that he probably wouldn't have approved. So the fatal encounter with a bear meant that they encountered each other. It was something beyond what we can understand. So one of the things I've learned last week is that the process of grieving for Indigenous people, because the Indigenous people he had lined up wanted to continue the course, and I offered to support that in any way that I could as an academic. So we learned that grieving in that context means three things that are very different from the meaning of grieving for Western cultures. Number one, grieving is collective. The thing about collectivizing the hearts, I knew that about trauma, but it was the first time that I've seen it manifesting as a collective video conference grieving with the speakers and the students. The second thing is that it involves humor, because the collectivizing of the heart to be able to sit with that pain also requires that we call in joy and remember him for the funny things that he did, as well as the contradictions, and that this laughter paves the way for him on the other side, for him to find the place that he needs to be in. It's laughter. So it was very moving, both in terms of this mixture of sorrow and joy in celebrating his life in hilarious ways. So hearing other people tell the stories was very healing. And third thing is something that I knew already from my experience with Maori people, but I got reminded that in this process of passing, for many Indigenous communities, it's also a process of settling things with the V, right? So, and finishing David's businesses. He can't go if these things are not settled. In Maori culture, for example, when you have the wake for somebody who has passed, people are invited to come. In many of the communities, people are invited to come and settle scores. So you hear people saying things about conflicts and because the person needs to go with that settled, right? The business of the deceased also needs to be settled, which in this case was we needed to finish that week of the course so that he would go at peace with his work having been completed. It was very moving. And I think because he worked so closely with Indigenous people that I'm sure he would have wanted, that was a good send-off. Let's put it like that. Since then, I felt much more peace with this loss, knowing that, again, from Indigenous perspectives, this is not a loss. It's just a passing into a different camp that where we meet again.
Our friends Dugald Hine and his better half, Anna, who founded a school called Home. Dugald was sharing yesterday in a conversation that Anna had recently pointed out to him or expressed the insight that the way we react so negatively to death says something about the fact that we're not living properly. Mm-hmm. That if we were living in a way that felt like it was closer to the proper way of living, death wouldn't cause us these reactions.
Yeah.
And I think what you just described is a very good example of a healthier way of dealing with death.
And it relates to what David said in the last recording. The last recording we have of David is actually with me in mm-hmm. his class, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at one point I leave the class because I had another Zoom to go to, and he continues with the student. And I had the opportunity to hear the rest of the recording on Saturday. And he finishes the recording telling the students to go gently into the night.
On that note, Vanessa, thank you so much for taking part in this podcast. I feel really, really privileged to know you.
Likewise.
And to be treading this difficult, but oh so hopeful in a healthy way, path. Thank you very, very much.